What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, weekly program for teens, their families and communities, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. In September 2009, 18-year-old Lawson Mayfield's life was cut short after she contracted bacterial meningitis. According to the National Meningitis Association, bacterial meningitis strikes an average of 1,500 Americans annually, with 1 in 7 cases proving fatal and another 20% of victims suffering serious long-term consequences. Lawson's parents, Kathy and Emery Mayfield, established the Lawson Mayfield Memorial Foundation to benefit the National Meningitis Association and increase the awareness of the disease. This year, the foundation will host the 5th annual Run for Lawson on Saturday, September 26, 2015. Joining me here at the roundtable, I'd like to welcome Kathy Mayfield. Kathy, glad to have you.
Thank you, Dr. Hollifield. We're so glad to be here again.
Glad to have you. A special welcome to Dr. Tamika Funny, Southeastern Center for Infectious Diseases. Dr. Funny is board certified in internal medicine and infectious diseases.
Thank you, Dr. Hollifield. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming. Thanks so much. And Claudia Blackburn. She's the health director for the Department of Health at Leon County.
And I'm very grateful to be invited today. Thank you for having me.
Well, we really appreciate you coming. And I'm Dr. Liz Hollifield. All right. Here we are, the 5th year. That's impressive, Kathy.
Thank you, Dr.
Hollifield.
Yeah,
we are great.
Thrilled. At this point to date, we have contributed over $130,000 to the National Meningitis Association.
That's wonderful.
Wow. So we are thrilled. And when we started, after we got over the initial shock of Lawson's death and wanted to do something to talk about meningitis, I just thought I knew absolutely nothing about bacterial meningitis until Lawson contracted it and died. So we reached out to the National Meningitis Association, and it's just very interesting. And I think now in today's climate, with all the different things that are going on as far as vaccinations and everything, that people just need to be aware. They need knowledge is power, and they need to know more about what these diseases are, if they're vaccine preventable. Some of them are, some of them aren't. And it's just a wide spectrum, not just bacterial meningitis, but just a very wide spectrum. So the National Meningitis Association does an excellent job of putting a lot of good information out there, and we're just really pleased with the success of Run for Lawson.
Well, I applaud you.
Thank you.
Since I've been involved from day one,
thank you.
Just seen it grow, and I just think it's great. It's fantastic. Share with us, as much as you're comfortable with, Lawson's situation, you know, what happened, how it evolved, because I think the listening audience can get an appreciation for just how quickly
it can strike.
It can strike.
Absolutely. I'll be glad to. Lawson, in September of 2009, had been traveling. She had been out of the country for a couple of weeks with her older sister, and she returned home on a Sunday evening. Lawson was an avid equestrian, and on Monday she rode, I think, 4 or 5 horses, which was not unusual, but she was exhausted, and she had had some migraines in the past. So late Monday afternoon, she had a headache, and headache is now, I know, one of headache, stiff neck, fever, very much flu-like symptoms are many of the things that are indicative of bacterial meningitis. I didn't think much about it because of the fact that she'd had headaches in the past. This one became progressively worse. She became lethargic, which is another sign. So about 8 o'clock on Monday night, we went to the emergency room, and literally they did a spinal tap on Lawson, which is the only way they can that they can identify bacterial meningitis. And they did that about 2 o'clock in the morning, which would be Tuesday, but and they did identify that it was bacterial meningitis. It then takes a while longer for them to identify exactly which type it is. Mm-hmm. And at that point, Lawson was literally in a coma. And we lost her on Wednesday of that week. So it was so quick. And that's when, after the first year and the shock became a little more, I don't know the word I'm looking for, but easier to cope with, we just started looking for things of trying to find a way that other people could be more aware of mm-hmm. things like that so that they wouldn't have to suffer the same thing we did.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Funny, would you tell us and talk to us about what is meningitis?
Well, meningitis is an inflammatory disease of the tissue surrounding the brain and the spinal cord and the fluid, and it's defined by abnormal white blood cells in the fluid that they do the lumbar puncture. And it's so true with what Kathy said, that most people have no idea what meningitis is mm-hmm. until it hits your home, mm-hmm. your family, a friend of the family. We hear about it in the news, but meningitis is such a quick-hitting disease that really and truly you don't know about it unless you come into contact with someone who has experienced the loss and how sudden it is and how devastating it can be. And it's so quick, and a lot of the symptoms are headaches, which majority of Americans and people worldwide Absolutely. Have headaches.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a more severe headache, something that you're not used to. It's not your mm-hmm. typical migraine, and it worsens throughout the day. So that's the difference. A lot of migraines are kind of hard, but they're chronic throughout the day. But with meningitis, it does not get better. You can have fevers, lethargic, what we call nuchal rigidity, which is neck stiffness.
Mm-hmm.
But until you really go to the hospital and get evaluated by a physician, it seems like you're just kind of under the weather, but a little bit more sicker than you're used to. And that's when we try to urge families to, okay, you have to come into the ER. We have to evaluate you and evaluate you quickly. And it happens very fast, very sudden. You have to jump on it. You have to get the lumbar puncture, which is a spinal tap, mm-hmm. in which we drain some of the fluid and we analyze the fluid in a microbiology lab. But in the meantime, of course, it takes a while for this analysis to return. We immediately start antibiotics.
I guess my question would be, because the signs and the symptoms that you've shared, how do you differentiate that from the flu? I mean, because I might think, oh, it sounds like the flu, you know, but it moves so fast.
Which is very common.
What do
and
people
that's,
do?
That's the problem with mm-hmm. meningitis,
mm-hmm.
is because time is crucial. Time is the most important factor. But because the symptoms are so nonspecific, we would call it, very flu-like, it's extremely difficult for a mother or a parent or a loved one to say, you know, do you just have the cold? Just lay down. Mm-hmm. Your headache will get better. Here's a Tylenol. Let's see how you feel. Because that's what we would normally do in a normal situation.
Right.
And unless you have some outside knowledge or expertise, it's extremely difficult for any family member to know what's going on. Your first thought will never be, oh, my child has meningitis, or my husband or my wife has meningitis. Let me take them to the ER. So it's just from education and programs like this, then they will say, you know, I heard a radio broadcast.
It kicks in. Because
kicks
that's
in.
That's what we felt like. I had no knowledge of meningitis. I had
Most
always heard
don't.
It associated with babies.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew nothing.
Right.
So it was frightening.
Now, Ms. Blackburn, you are at the head of the Leon County Health Department. Do you all encounter meningitis, or how is it addressed in the health department?
Well, our job at the health department is to follow up on all reportable diseases.
Mm-hmm.
Most of those are communicable diseases, and meningitis is one of those. So bacterial meningitis is one of those. And so when there's a case of meningitis and the lab picks it up or the doctor picks it up or the hospital picks it up, we get a call and it is reported to us. And then our job is to, you know, follow up and make sure that the person's getting treated. And really, in a case like this, that's always happening. and to follow up on the contacts to the person that has meningitis. So our job is to figure out who's a close contact and who needs to receive antibiotics to prevent them from getting meningitis. And, you know, it's not highly contagious, but people who are exposed do have a much higher risk of getting it. But even so, it's not a high risk. Mm-hmm. It's a low risk. But because it's a zero, it's not a no risk. Mm-hmm. We certainly want to do everything we can to prevent somebody else from getting ill because they've been exposed.
Now, how does one contract meningitis? And I'll just throw that out to all of you, whoever wants to respond to it.
Well, you know, people get meningitis usually when they're sharing maybe a drink with somebody else, they're kissing. That's why, you know, we vaccinate children that are going into college because they're living, many of them are close living in a dormitory, crowded situation. They're sharing food. They're sharing cigarettes, unfortunately, not so much in Tallahassee, but some is still going on. But just lots of sharing of saliva and mucus, and that's mainly how it's spread. I mean, if somebody's infected with meningitis and they cough directly into your face, you may also get it that way.
Okay. Can you share the demographics that are related to meningitis? I don't know if you have any here in this area in Leon, but just who do we see getting meningitis?
Well, I mean, from my standpoint, the ages are kind of, it varies with the form of meningitis. Mm-hmm. Of course, young children are always susceptible to many things, meaning newborns to 2-year-olds all the way up to around the toddler age. They're highly susceptible to streptococcal meningitis and to Haemophilus influenza B, but that has really decreased both of those because of the vaccinations, which it has shown over the years that the curve has really gone down with the push of vaccinating infants and toddlers. And then you go up to the high school, college children that are more highly susceptible to meningococcal, army grads, army barracks, close contact, even prison and jail.
I got to take a brief break for the cause. You tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and this hour we are talking about meningitis. We are focusing on the Lawson Mayfield Memorial Foundation, and they are having their fifth annual run for the National Meningitis Association. Joining me here at the roundtable again, I welcome Dr. Tamika Funny, Ms. Claudia Blackburn, and Kathy Mayfield. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. I had to interrupt you.
Yes.
So, Dr. Funny, would you continue?
So we're at the college and people in close contact, and then you jump to the older communities, the greater than 65, who also, you know, decreased immunity, and they're they kind of jump back into the higher risk group with the streptococcal, haemophilus, being especially with the older community, we really see a little bit of insurgence with haemophilus B because they weren't vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
We started vaccination much later.
That's interesting.
Exactly, and we always recommend older than 65 getting the vaccination. And also you have people who are just immunocompromised. They don't have a spleen or they have immunodeficiencies. Mm-hmm. They have HIV. You always have the population that have a decreased immunity that are at risk for almost every and anything. So we definitely push for their vaccination.
Now, I know we really are focusing on bacterial meningitis, but Dr. Funny, would you at least
address just a little bit about the viral meningitis? And I know there's a fungal infection. Would you talk about that just a little bit?
So that's definitely less of a concern, but still very can cause a lot of symptoms and sequelae, and patients still get very sick. Viral meningitis is very it's actually prominent summertime and springtime. We see actually a lot of it in the hospitals. Patients come in and they have these major headaches. They get a lumbar puncture, but it doesn't have the high white blood cell count and the things that normally we see with bacteria, but they have symptoms of fevers, headaches, neck stiffness, the same
exact same symptoms.
But when we test it, they're negative for bacterial, and then they're found to have viral. The most common one at this time is enterovirus. Enterovirus is very common spring, fall, but the best thing about that is that you don't need medication.
They just run its course.
You need supportive care, treatment for your headaches, fluids, and rest. Fungals is even more less of a risk, and it really came to the forefront the last few years with the steroid injections and things of that nature, in which it was just how the compound was made up and it caused some fungal meningitis. But normally we really don't see that in the community nearly as often, which, thank God, because it's very, very devastating. Fungal meningitis is extremely difficult to treat.
Now, Ms. Blackburn, I know you, again, with the health department. I want to digress a little bit, because if you would just share what the health department does, just for the listening audience, you know, what services you provide. Individuals may not be dealing with meningitis, but they, you know, the health department offers a number of other services. And so if you would share those at this point.
Sure. Well, the health department really has a foot in two different worlds. One is the world of the community, where we're involved with assessing the community for health risks and health issues that the residents of Leon County care about, and then pulling together partners to help work on some of those issues, things like obesity, tobacco use, infant mortality. You know, those are issues that we partner with other organizations to work on. So that's sort of the external part of what we do. But we also have some clinical services still. We are not the place that you come if you're sick and you need a doctor. And we're still educating people about that, because I think historically people did come to the health department for medical care. We recommend that people go to either a private doctor or Bond or Neighborhood Medical Center, one of the local community health centers, if they're ill or if they need a regular doctor. But we provide services like family planning and WIC program, which is Women, Infant, and Children Nutritional Education and Supplementation Program, with a lot of emphasis on breastfeeding, promoting breastfeeding. We also follow up on people that have sexually transmissible diseases, and or people that think they've been exposed, and they come to see us, and we can do an exam, we can diagnose, and we can treat, and we can contact the contacts. It's all confidential, so nobody knows how we got their name. We also do immunizations. We do a lot of special immunization clinics, and then we provide immunizations through our clinic for people that don't have a doctor or people who can't get in with their doctor and need immunizations.
So if I want a flu shot, can I come there?
You can come to the health department for a flu shot. We do lots of special flu clinics.
Okay.
And you do have to make an appointment for a vaccination, and the number is 606-8000. You have to make an appointment for all of our services.
Where are you located?
We are located actually in several different places, but for the clinic, the Roberts and Stevens Clinic, it is 1515 Old Bainbridge Road. And we also have a WIC clinic at the Richardson Lewis Clinic, which is 872 West Orange Avenue.
Okay. So you could get the meningococcal vaccination?
Yes, we do. Okay. We give the Haemophilus influenza B vaccination that Dr. Funny was talking about. We give that to infants 2, 4, 6 months, and 12 to 15 months is the booster. And then we also give the meningitis vaccination to children that are 11 to 13, you know, entering mm-hmm. seventh grade usually, and then the booster dose at 16 to 18. And so the colleges here, FAMU and FSU, require, it's state law, that that they're supposed to mm-hmm.
educate
the students right. about mm-hmm. meningitis and the need for the vaccine. And if you choose not to be vaccinated, you actually have to sign a form saying that you decline the vaccine.
Okay. Kathy, again, I can't believe it. It's the fifth annual benefit.
I know.
Tell us the who, what, when, where.
We'd love to. This year, the Run for Lawson will begin at 8:30 on September 26th. So we're just a couple of weeks out. We'll start. The 8:30 will be the fun, what we call the fun walk run. And 9 o'clock are the serious runners with the 5 and the 10K. The run is located, it starts on the athletic fields of Holy Comforter Episcopal School, which is on Fleischman Road between Centerville Road and Miccosukee. It runs through this incredibly beautiful plantation, Wilani Plantation Grounds, and it's hilly and it's gorgeous and it's just beautiful. It's pristine and there are trees, there are woods, there are pastures. It's incredibly gorgeous and challenging. So we will start there again at 8:30, 9 o'clock for the 10K and the 5K. Registration will be open from 7:30 to 8:30. And we also have pre-registration at Gold's Gym on Capitol Circle Northeast on Thursday and Friday, Thursday and Friday from 4 to 7. And anybody can come in, whether they can come in if they've already registered online. At runforlawson.org, they can go on there and just sign up, or you can come in and sign up for the same price at Gold's Gym if you'd like to come. It's a little bit more the day of. It's $20 before if you sign up before Friday or before, and then $25 the morning of.
Okay. All right. Now, let me just make sure I have this right. With meningitis, bacterial meningitis, the membranes around the brain and the spinal cord are really inflamed, okay? Can you get bacterial meningitis, or can it start with a sore throat or an earache or a strep throat? I'm just wondering, you know, all that's kind of connected, right?
It is, and especially children. A lot mm-hmm. of children have mm-hmm. earache, ear infections, and then it gets to their spreads to the surrounding tissue and inflammation. So a lot of times it does start from a source of mm-hmm. you know of the bacteria, and then it can spread. But also it can be as we were saying before, catching it from someone who was close to you or close contact. Mm-hmm. So it can be both, but definitely it can start from a streptococcal infection.
Can healthy people carry the bacteria and not get sick, like maybe carry it in their nasal passages or in their throat and not really have the symptoms? Is that
possible? Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of people have chronic tonsillitis and chronic, mm-hmm. you know, and then they don't get meningitis from that. So, you know, it all depends on the person and sometimes their ability to fight off infections. Also, how much of bacteria they're inundated with. Mm-hmm. But, of course, we've all had infections, bacterial infections, but not have meningitis and not get as bad as you.
Okay. Can one get meningitis from non-infections? I mean, I guess I'm thinking like lupus. Allergies.
Not bacterial.
Okay.
Not bacterial,
but you can get.
But you can have like a viral. If you have a virus, and it leads to this virus, then leads to meningitis.
Mm-hmm.
But not from a condition.
Okay.
Itself. But those, some of those, of course, are called aseptic.
Okay.
Meningitis, and aseptic meningitis is not bacterial. Mm-hmm. It can be from any cause that causes inflammation of the brain. Mm-hmm. Sometimes patients with cancers or different head cancers have aseptic meningitis, which is just inflammation of the tissue. So that's a very in-depth world, and it becomes a little bit more specific to try to find out what is the cause of that meningitis. But aseptic meningitis is very vast.
Okay. And I guess another question I wonder, of course, one wouldn't really know. Could one have meningitis and not really know it? And I don't mean just bacteria, because I know bacterial moves. But I'm wondering, could you have meningitis and it just kind of run its course and you don't feel that great, but you're okay?
Mostly not, because meningitis, you get very, very ill and very sick. So eventually you will know, and your family members will know that something is wrong.
Now, we talked about, you alluded to some of the complications that were associated with meningitis. Do you mind sharing those with us at this point?
A lot of the complications, especially in we could start with the younger community, a lot of children can have seizures. A lot of them have ongoing seizures at the hospital, and even when they come home, they're still on anti-seizure medications, mm-hmm. because a lot of young people respond to fevers with seizures. You can have neurological deficits, okay. in which even after you're treated, we call that the sequelae, the complications are the pretty much what happens after treatment. You have almost stroke-like sometimes. You have some neurological deficits. Some children could almost seem as if they have cerebral palsy because mm-hmm. they have these neurological deficits. A lot of hearing loss. A lot of hearing mm-hmm. loss is associated with mm-hmm. meningitis in young and in old. A lot of times from the infection itself with children, it starts from an ear infection. So they have the regrowth of bone and a lot of the destruction of bone that causes the hearing loss. And then in the some of the older community, it's the antibiotics. We have to give them high-powered antibiotics. So we have to really flood them with these antibiotics to try to decrease the burden of the bacteria. And because of these antibiotics, some of the risk factors with antibiotics is kidney damage, hearing loss. But in order to save their lives, we have to do our best. And we just, tell the families that this could be some of the complications of that.
I guess what I want to say is the longer one goes untreated, is that when you start to see even more neurological damage? I mean, is there a relationship between that, the complications? Do they reflect on the treatment? I mean, are there just going to be
regardless? Yes and no. Definitely okay. If you catch it early, which we have caught meningitis very early, of course their outcome can be better. But then the more damage as time goes on, they do have a worsened outcome. But sometimes the burden of the bacteria is just so much, even if you catch it early, you could still have a lot of complications.
Okay. This hour, we are honoring Lawson Mayfield, an amazing young woman whose life was cut short by bacterial meningitis. The Lawson Mayfield Memorial Foundation will hold its fifth annual benefit in honor of Lawson, who made an indelible mark on everyone who crossed her path. Her sudden passing sent shockwaves through her family, friends, and the entire Tallahassee community. And looking at bacterial meningitis, how is a definitive diagnosis made of bacterial meningitis? I mean, I know you mentioned the culture. Is there any x-rays involved, any CT? You mentioned the lumbar puncture. But just can you share with us, how a definitive diagnosis is made?
Well, meningitis is defined by abnormal white blood cell count.
Okay, so that's...
It's the definition of an abnormal spinal fluid mm-hmm. lumbar tap, in which they pull the fluid. The fluid shows infection. White blood cells is always around when infection is around. So the higher your white blood cells are, the more indicative that is of bacterial meningitis. Sometimes viral meningitis, aseptic meningitis are low. White blood cells.
Excuse me for interrupting. So therefore, things like acupuncture would not do it.
No, ma'am.
Okay, but I think it's important for
yes,
us to
exactly.
say that. That's why, I was leading. You can't go to the acupuncturist and think that they're going to take care of this meningitis.
No, ma'am.
Okay.
No, ma'am.
All right. Continue.
So that's how we diagnose meningitis. And then we then send this fluid off to a lab in which, just like old school science lab, they put it on a little petri dish and they test it. They look for what we call a Gram stain. So just like science lab, they look at the bacteria. And if there's bacteria there, definitely we know there is an infection. And then it takes a few days for them to identify that bacteria because that's a longer process. Mm-hmm. But they get this what they call a Gram stain very quickly, in which the microbiologist, they know they have a spinal fluid, and it's extremely important for them to get the results to the doctor as soon as possible. So they immediately
What are you talking about?
They usually look at it within hours, and they'll give you yes, this is we have a positive Gram stain here. I see bacteria on this petri dish. Please, they call the physician. It's not just something they put in the computer. They call these
results immediately. And they usually, even before they know, if it looks funny, they're going to immediately start aggressive treatment and assume that it's worst-case scenario.
Exactly. They look at that white blood cell count in the lumbar fluid, and we automatically know, wow, we have a lot of white blood cells here. We're dealing with a major infection.
Okay. Kathy, I want you to talk about the aggressive treatment because you said they usually start aggressive treatment. And I'll probably have to interrupt you, but at least if you can start to tell
us
about
that. That's fine. I'll be glad to because we were there again so uneducated, and one of the doctors in the emergency room said, you know, I really want to look at her spinal fluid and to rule out meningitis because I, of course, this is just a really terrible migraine. Mm-hmm. And when he came back and he said, we've got a problem. It's definitely obvious that there's bacterial infection in here. And he said, and we are going to treat it.
Hold your thoughts for a minute. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll return momentarily. Kathy Mayfield, Lawson's mother, shares the history of Lawson with 411 Teen. Dr. Tamika Funny, Southeastern Center for Infectious Disease, and Claudia Blackburn, Health Officer of the Leon County Health Department, join 411 Teen this hour to increase awareness with bacterial meningitis. Kathy, I had to interrupt you, but you were sharing about just how aggressive treatment is.
Absolutely. The doctor in the emergency room just felt like with her symptoms that there was a chance that there was bacterial meningitis. And if nothing else, he wanted to, you know, rule it out. Well, it came back that when he looked himself, evidently he was able to do that. Mm-hmm. And he said, we've got a problem. He said, so I'm going to treat it just as if it's the worst case of bacterial meningitis. And he, at that point, was very candid with me about, he said, you know, she's very, very, very healthy, very strong. And she was a very strong young woman. And he said, I feel like we're in good shape. He said, or I feel positive about it. He said, but he went through some of the main things, the hearing loss, blindness he talked about, and definite neurological problems that could be the aftermath of bacterial meningitis. And I, you know, of course, was in shock, and I just thought, certainly this is not good. Well, you know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I just couldn't wrap my head around it. Mm-hmm. So, there again, it got progressively worse, and she had some seizures in the emergency room, and then they moved her into ICU, and she really was in a coma that she never recovered from. But I was very impressed looking back on how they immediately went to the most aggressive type of treatment they could go to.
How do we prevent it, Ms. Blackburn? How do we prevent meningitis?
Well,
and I know we have the the immunization, okay, but...
Well, immunizations is the main thing. And, you know, it's not a perfect immunization, but it helps. And so for children, we recommend the Haemophilus influenza B vaccination, and that is at 2 and 4 months, and then 12 to 15 months.
Okay.
And I think it's 2, 4, 6, and 12 to 15 months. And then for older children, 11 to 13, going into 7th grade, we recommend a meningitis vaccination. And again, when they're going to college, about 5 years later, 16 to 18, a vaccination before they go to college. And some of the universities here require it whether they're going to live at home or in a dorm. We know that in a dorm, you know, that it's crowded. There's a lot of sharing of drinks and kissing and touching, and it's just very close. And so that seems to be a very high-risk age group for meningitis.
Okay. Now, I know, Dr. Funny, you mentioned the age group over 65 being very high risk. Is there a vaccination that they get at this
point?
Yes,
they get the pneumococcal, the streptococcal vaccination also. And we also have to remember, a lot of people forget, we have a lot of older individuals going back to college. We have a lot of mothers and, you know, women and men returning to college after maybe they want to start a new career or whatever their decision is. And they, too, we do recommend that they get the vaccine. And also we have to remind the people of the booster. If you're not sure how long it's been, if it's been over 5 years, you need to get the booster. And if you received it at the 11th, 12th, you need a booster going into college. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways and different avenues to have how you can fit into that vaccine. There's charts galore to tell you who should be vaccinated and why. And even travelers traveling to places in the world that has a high meningococcal rate, they have to get the meningococcal vaccine. And a lot of our travelers who come to our travel clinic, that's one thing they never think about that they need. And we have to look at the map, and if they're at high risk for meningitis, they need the meningococcal vaccine. So the list is very it's large, and your primary care physician will look and to see how you fit. And there's either age, or is it because you have an immunodeficiency? Is it because you're traveling? Is it because you're returning to college? Is it because you're going off to college? Are you going to enter into the Army? Are you know, there, we catch a lot of people in a lot of different ways.
And, you know, last year we had an outbreak in several colleges of the serogroup B. Bacterial meningitis, which is one that we've not seen much of in the United States. They have been in Europe. Europe actually has a vaccination. Of course, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work in the United States, but it is available. And the CDC is recommending that kids going off to college talk to their healthcare provider and see if they would recommend that they get that vaccination as well.
Well, Ms. Bachburn, do you have any stats on just how many people get vaccinated? I mean, do these young kids, if it's not required and you can kind of sign a waiver, that's my question. Who is getting vaccinated? I mean, really, we know all of them need it. It sounds like if you go to college, you need it. Yeah, especially if you're going to live in a dorm. Okay.
Well, that's a great question. I actually don't have the answer, but I know that when there's a policy where a vaccination is required, that generally the rate of declination is low. Most people will heed the advice and get vaccinated just as a matter of course.
Okay, so you're
I'm confident that it's pretty high, and we can certainly look into that for the next call.
Well, what made me think about it, I was thinking about, you know, the whole measles outbreak and how people were, I don't want my child
and
to have measles.
That's
right. And whooping cough. Yeah, you don't want your child to have the vaccination, but then you put everybody else
at risk.
At risk.
Absolutely.
I mean,
It's a long going, ongoing battle when it comes to vaccines. And, you know, it's very hard to change the minds of some people who are adamant that, you know, this is not for my child. And all we can do as healthcare providers and as the public and as a servant to our community is inform. All I can do is give you the information, and you will take whatever you can from it, make an educated decision. But we always try to get through to every and anyone that this is what we feel is the best. We have research to back it up. And then you have all the information, and it's up to you to make the decision. And, of course, the community is at risk for people who opt not to vaccine, but it's been an ongoing battle. Since the first vaccine came out, it's been an ongoing issue.
Right.
And all we can do as providers is provide information.
Okay.
I will say that we have a very high rate of children that are up to date on their vaccinations in our school system, in the Leon County school system. It's over 95%. And maybe when they enter school, there are a few more that have decided not to get vaccinated. But once they have perhaps been through an outbreak of pertussis where their child is excluded from school for 21 days because they have been in a school or been exposed to a case of pertussis, you know, they begin to sort of weigh the pros and cons of getting vaccinated versus not. And slowly, most of those children end up getting vaccinated.
And how effective are the vaccinations?
Well, every vaccination is different, and I'm sure Dr. Funny can comment on that. But for this particular vaccination, it's somewhere between 69% and 85%, depending on when you get it, depending on, you know, your own immune status. But it does seem to wane. The effectiveness does seem to decrease after with time, and so that's why now this booster is recommended after 5 years.
Exactly. It's exactly what you said. You know, any vaccine, just like the flu vaccine, they're made up with different serotypes. They're made up with different types of, you know, viruses or different types of bacterial strains. And a lot of children still get streptococcal meningitis, and they've had all the shots, but that's because they had a different strain. They caught a different strain that was in the vaccine. Vaccines cannot provide 100% immunity, or they don't have a 100% effective rate, but they do reduce the risk. And sometimes also, if you might get the disease, the flu or whatever, but it decreases the severity of it. So a lot of people, even if they get the flu from the and they had the flu shot, they say, well, I got the flu shot, but you might not have been as sick as you would have been. It really decreases the severity. And vaccines aren't 100% accurate, but they're made up with a lot of common strains, and we can hit as much as we can, but that's why it's not 100% effective.
Now, what about any alternative complementary medical practices? Are there any? I know I mentioned to you about acupuncture, but I'm thinking about homeopathy, because I think it's so important that I come back to this, you know. Just was reminded that so many people believe in alternative, and not that anything is wrong with alternative, I'm not saying that, but how are there any effective alternative practices, medical practices that would be recommended?
I mean, what I can say from my standpoint is that anything that helps your immune system. So people who live a healthy life and they take vitamins and they do their best to boost their immune system, that's never a disadvantage.
Okay.
Young people are healthy, vibrant, can fight off so many more infections than old people. But as you can see, young people still at 17, that's the strongest you can be at 17.
Mm-hmm.
You have the most energy you'll ever have in your life, a 17-year-old. But as you can see, it can still cause devastating loss. So you cannot treat meningitis with homeopathic or vitamins. This is something that requires antibiotics. It will not get better outside of medical attention.
That's that's what I really wanted to hear, because I think that there's a large group of individuals that, at least that I have encountered, that seem to be anti-medical. And some things may work, but this is just not one of those things. So, and I wanted really to convey that.
That's correct.
Why I keep going, this is not one of those conditions, diseases that, you know, you can just wish away or take megavitamins. You know, megavitamin therapy is something that you will hear people taking. And yeah. I think they need to understand that this is not going to be effective. Talk a little bit about the prognosis. And once one does have bacterial meningitis, and I know that's going to vary depending upon, you know, just the degree. But can you talk a little bit about that, please?
I mean, the prognosis, if you say, varies, depends on age and how quickly you seek medical attention. Mm-hmm. And once you get into a Glasgow coma or a scale in which you have really decreased neurological ability, or you have severe defects, you might not have you have a higher mortality rate. But overall, the morbidity mortality is better as time goes on, because we're seeing it more often. We're approaching it from a medical community much quicker. Sometimes, of course, we want the lumbar puncture first, but if we cannot obtain a lumbar puncture, mm-hmm. we immediately go to treatment. So we, as a medical community, we know that time is not on our side. And in order to really aggressively treat this patient, to give them more of a higher probability of surviving this, we start treatment quicker. And that has, of course, improved the morbidity, mortality of meningitis, and with vaccinations, too.
When does one go to the doctor? I mean, are there some indicators that you would just recommend for parents or for young folks who may be, you know, out on their own, that says maybe you need to go to the doctor? Because I think, again, so often you get the flu, you get the sniffles, and you think, I'll be all right. You know, I'm used to this. But when do they go? I mean, is there any?
Yes, there's different ways to kind of tell. If you know your child has history of headaches, it becomes a little bit difficult. But if this is a headache that they say, you should ask, is this like your typical headache? Is this like your normal migraine? Uh-huh. And that they say, no, Mom or Dad, it's a little different.
We were a perfect example. Yeah. When I said, let's go to the hospital, and she didn't even bat an eye.
Oh, that's it.
And I thought, and this, you know, this was in the, it was like over a 3-hour time period. We mm-hmm. weren't talking about 2 days. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just, yeah. it was obvious that it was different.
It was different. Mm-hmm. And that's the majority of what people mm-hmm. say. This is different. And okay. all of my patients, they tell you, I have migraines, but this was different. And that's typically what you would hear. Of course, if you see lethargy or very fatigue, not really waking up as much, that is a crucial mm-hmm. time that you really have to get that person in as soon as possible, because it's starting to kind of take over their body.
There's also
their body
a rash
down.
can occur.
Oh, okay.
If they see any of that, you need to go immediately.
Yeah.
Okay. Kathy, share the info.
I would love to. Okay. September 26th, our 1-mile walk run starts at 8:30. The 5 and 10K starts at 9 o'clock a.m. We're on the athletic field of Holy Comforter Episcopal School between Miccosukee and Centerville. It is a chip-timed run for those serious runners.
Okay.
So we will, as I said, start at 9 o'clock. We have registration running that morning of from 7:30 to 8:30. Pre-registration can be picked up at Gold's Gym on the Thursday and Friday from 4 to 7 on Capitol Circle Northeast, and you can also come by and register there.
All right. And Claudia Blackburn, please share where the health department is, you know, for those who need to know.
Well, for those who want immunization services, we are at 1515 Old Bainbridge Road.
Okay.
We're open 8 to 5, except on Fridays. We are closed Friday afternoons. But you need to call for an appointment, 606-8000.
And in this last minute, I'm going to digress a little bit, but several people have asked me to ask you this. Dr. Funny, comment on this year's anticipated flu season. They're like, ask her, make sure before she leaves you ask her. So I'm getting it in real quick.
Well, the flu season has already began, actually. Mm-hmm. We've already seen flu in the emergency rooms. So I got my flu shot today.
Okay. All right.
So I would definitely say the flu vaccine is out. And we did start early, but last year we started earlier too. We're hoping it's a better vaccine this year than last year. Last year we somewhat missed the mark as far as the strain, but we really won't know until mid or towards the middle of the flu season to see how we're doing.
Okay, so the earlier the better.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, my appreciation to all of you for coming. And to my listening audience, I invite you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. This edition of 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollifield. Technical assistance, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Team podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.